early identification of these disorders was absolutely imperative to being able to help minimize the progression of the disorders. It's absolutely clear that these things, the newborn screening aspect of things, is going to be able to help us offer more hope to the families for these patients that are affected with these rare, difficult disorders.
On today's Newborn Screening Spotlight podcast, we have a special guest who's made a significant impact on inherited metabolic and storage disease research and has led innovative gene therapies for rare diseases. On a personal note, I met Dr. Paul Orchard over 3 decades ago when he was part of the team who treated my son, Joey, who was born with severe combined immune deficiency. And this was even before SCID was part of routine newborn screening. So I'm one of the lucky ones who got to have Dr. Orchard personally touch my lives. And we're so excited to introduce him today, as well as his journey to all of you during our podcast. Dr. Paul Orchard is the medical director of the Inherited Metabolic and Storage Disease Program and a professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Blood and Marrow Transplant and Cellular Therapy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Orchard is interested in the use of hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cell therapies, including gene therapy, to improve outcomes in newborns and children born with a disease. In addition to his clinical work with patients who have inherited metabolic diseases, Dr. Orchard is engaged in research designed to identify novel strategies to enhance the delivery of enzymes to the brain and the peripheral nervous system for patients who lack specific enzymes. Other interests for Dr. Orchard include the modification of stem cell transplant approaches and combination therapies to improve outcomes for patients with inherited diseases. And Dr. Orchard is looking into the potential to develop multi-institutional cooperative studies for these disorders. Listen in today as a leading expert talks about saving the lives of children every day, including my son, Joey.
Hello, this is the Newborn Screening Spotlight. This podcast is about the advancement of rare disease research told by health professionals, researchers, parents, and advocates. This podcast is for you to learn how newborn screening research saves the lives of babies every day through the discovery of new technology and treatment. You will hear stories from experts who treat babies, the families who care for them, and the researchers who make it all happen. We are your co-hosts. I am Dr. Ki Chan.
And I'm Dr. Amy Brower. We're from the Newborn Screening Translational Research Network, also known as the NBSTRN. Our work is supported by one of the institutes at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, called the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, also known as NICHD. Dr. Chan and I are from the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, also known as ACMG, and ACMG leads the MBSTRN. Screening babies saves lives every day, and research advances newborn screening by developing new technologies to screen, diagnose, and treat. MBSTRN helps accelerate research by creating tools, resources, and expertise for researchers, doctors, families, patients, and advocates.
To learn how you can help advance newborn screening research, advocate for rare disease screening and treatment, and learn about important discovery, become a member of the Newborn Screening Translational Research Network by visiting our website at www.mbstrn.org.
Hi, Dr. Orchard. We're thrilled to have you join us today on the Newborn Screening Spotlight podcast. Dr. Orchard, you're currently the professor in the Department of Pediatrics and a faculty member at the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation and Cellular Therapy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Orchard, you're a bone marrow transplant specialist
at the Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplant Center, and your research has focused on the use of hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cell therapies for inherited metabolic disorders. A little over 30 years ago, I was actually at the University of Minnesota for a bone marrow transplant for my then six-month-old son, Joey, for severe combined immune deficiency. So you may have seen us in the halls or been part of Joey's care team. So thank you for the great care that we received at your center. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in newborn screening and your interest in research in inherited metabolic disorders?
Sure. Thanks, Amy, for inviting me to participate today. So excited to share what we do. So yeah, that was a long title, but so I'm a pediatrician essentially, and then I did additional training, and the training group of disciplines is hematology oncology, which is more the leukemia and solid tumor sort of side of things, and then bone marrow transplantation. And I gravitated towards the transplant side of things. And I was quite interested in the genetic disorders. The University of Minnesota has been on the ground floor of developing transplantation and testing transplantation for some of these rare diseases, and particularly the lysosomal disorders and the peroxisomal disorders. And so I became a part of that group. And over time, that's really become virtually my entire practice now. So I take care of the other kids because of the leukemia and whatnot when I'm on the transplant floor. But in terms of my clinic and the new patients I see, they're virtually all kids that have rare genetic disorders that could potentially benefit from transplant. So, you know, over the years, we figured out, well, maybe just back up and we talk a little bit about the rationale for this is because that may not be necessarily that straightforward. But as these lysosomal disorders, for instance, were identified, and this goes back decades, people postulated that if you can put a cell that is devoid of an enzyme in the, you know, the body of the people that are being transplanted, and you have blood cells that have the capacity to make this enzyme, that those blood cells can circulate through the body, provide some enzyme, and the other cells in the patient being transplanted can pick up that enzyme and utilize it. So that was really the rationale to get started. The first patient transplanted for a lysosomal disorder was actually in the UK, but the first one done here in the US was done here. That was an MPS6 patient actually. And then virtually a lot of these lysosomal disorders over time, we explored the use of transplant for, and it became clear that it works quite well for some diseases and not so well for others. And then as enzyme therapy became available, for instance, then we had to help better determine what diseases might be amenable to transplant and which should just go on enzyme therapy. So, but as enzyme therapy doesn't penetrate into the central nervous system very well and treat the neurologic manifestations of some of these diseases, transplant is an opportunity to do that. So some of the cells from the donor can make their way into the brain and provide enzyme to the central nervous system, whereas infused enzyme doesn't make it across the blood-brain barrier very well. So most of the disorders that we still use transplant for have a neurologic aspect to them. It also became quite clear that we were getting the best results in treating patients as early as feasible. So from that standpoint, being able to identify these patients by newborn screening so that we can intervene before they lose ground is really key. It's much easier to help prevent the progression of the disease than it is to reverse the disease issues when they start.
So is that why newborn screening is so important? Because you can identify these kids pre-symptomatically and then intervene with a transplant?
Yeah, absolutely. And so a number of the diseases that we currently treat, so MPS1, well, Hurler, the more severe manifestations of MPS1, is one of the ones that we see commonly. We've got two patients on the transplant floor right now that that have MPS1. But from a neurocognitive standpoint, for instance, if you've lost a significant amount of ground because you were diagnosed reasonably late, transplant doesn't restore any of that function. So being able to intervene as early as we can with transplant really makes a difference. And it seems to also help, at least to some degree, on the musculoskeletal aspects of things. It's again, the kids seem to grow a bit better if we can intervene earlier. A lot of the surgeries that the patients might otherwise need, if we can intervene early, that seems to make a difference in terms of some of those outcomes as well. So I think just across the board, transplantation early in the course of the disease clearly makes a big difference in terms of outcomes.
Dr. Orchard, thank you so much for sharing how you got involved in newborn screening. You're also involved in clinical research, which involves the development of new and combination therapy to decrease toxicity and improve outcomes, with particular interest in the use of gene therapy approaches. One study showed that gene therapy could provide clinically relevant benefits for children with early onset metachromatic leukodystrophy, known as MLD. What are the advantages and limitations of innovative gene therapy approaches? What is your vision of gene therapy in the next few decades?
Well, that's an important question. So as I mentioned, we've been treating patients with diseases like MLD for really decades. And I'd like to think we made a lot of strides in terms of transplantation. We've got better supportive care now. We have better opportunity to find good donors. And so the risks associated with transplantation have decreased over time, but they're still significant. And I generally would tell a family that if we're considering transplantation for an affected child, that they're going to be in the hospital for 6 weeks or longer. The chance that there may be a life-threatening complication, such as an infection or graft versus host disease or a rejection of the donor cells, for instance, and that may lead to the death of the patient, maybe 15% of the kids that we transplant die going through the transplant itself. So it's a significant risk, and it's a very difficult process to put the kids through and the entire family through. So here, about 85% of the kids that are transplanted for these kinds of metabolic disorders aren't local. They're not from the Minnesota area. They come from all over the country and even potentially internationally. So it's a very difficult process to go through. The gene therapy that we're looking at is a lentiviral-based, what we call ex vivo gene therapy, which essentially means rather than using somebody else's blood stem cells, we would take the blood stem cells from the child that has the disorder, and then you can engineer those cells in the laboratory to make enzyme. And that's done with a virus called a lentivirus, which is actually based on the HIV virus, the AIDS virus. But all of the ability of that virus to replicate itself and actually cause an infection is then removed genetically. And the gene that's important for the patients that were treated has been inserted into the virus, because the virus is quite facile at getting into the blood cells. So essentially the process is we would take the kid's own blood stem cells out, and there's a process called apheresis to do that. But those cells are then shipped off to be engineered at the manufacturing site. The virus is used to introduce the gene into the cells, the patient's own blood stem cells, and it actually inserts itself into the DNA. So as those cells proliferate and grow and create more cells, the copy of that virus is then carried along with it. And so there's opportunity for those cells to make enzyme, and actually they make more enzyme than normal cells would. So when we think about these kinds of therapies, there's two big parts of it. One is the safety, And the other is, how well does it work to actually treat the disease? And for using your own cells, the risk of dying going through the transplant is not zero, but it's probably 1%, 2%. So it's tenfold less than if we had to use somebody else's cells, because that's a much more complicated process. So I don't think there's any doubt that it's safer to be able to use the patient's own cells that are engineered to make enzyme rather than to use somebody else's cells. And as I mentioned, there's the opportunity to actually make more enzyme with gene therapy than you can provide using a donor. And so it has that capacity to be actually more effective as well as safer. So those are the things that we really need to better understand. I mean, the gene therapy availability is just coming online, essentially. There are some of these that are now licensed. Metachromatic leukodystrophy, or MLD, that we were just referring to, is licensed in Europe at this point, but not in the US. And we have the capability of being able to treat some of these patients with MLD here, but it's on a single patient basis, and we have to contact the FDA and get approval to do that, and the company sponsor has to approve that as well. And so we have to write patient-specific protocols to do that, which is kind of laborious and time-consuming, but we can offer the therapy. So we've treated 4 patients now. The most recent one, we just got her cells yesterday, and we have the opportunity then to follow the patients along. And the first 3 that are now out more than a year are doing well. So we're excited about the opportunity to be able to offer new therapy and potentially, again, make it safer and more efficacious than where we've been before and the treatments we've been able to offer traditionally, which is the bone marrow transplant route. But for instance, for MLD, most of the patients that have been treated pre-symptomatically, and because it works much better in that circumstance than whether the patients are having some symptoms. But to find the patients pre-symptomatically, newborn screening hasn't been available for MLD. And so almost all the patients that have been treated are the second siblings of patients that were likely died of their MLD. So it's a small proportion of patients, as you might imagine, that have had an older sibling that have previously been diagnosed. So being able to offer newborn screening for MLD is going to be a very important aspect of our opportunity to treat these patients. So we're looking forward towards developing the newborn screening for MLD, and we're trying to move that forward here in Minnesota, and there's other states like Illinois, for instance, that are trying to move that forward at this point as well.
Thanks, Dr. Orchard, for that important summary of all this great work. Shifting gears to another disease, thinking about X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy, you and your colleagues published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine describing an important study on the LentiD drug product. Can you tell us a little bit about what the significance of that study and the outcomes in XALD that you found, and take the opportunity to remind us all of the differences between an autologous and allogeneic stem cell transplant and why these advancements are, you know, really the hope for the future?
Sure. Yeah, so the term allogeneic, which basically means using somebody else's cells. So that's what we've done historically for these types of diseases. The gold standard would be if you had a brother or sister, for instance, that was a good match. Finding a donor that's well-matched is kind of a key thing. But being able to find a well-matched donor is really important to trying to minimize the risks of transplant. But yes, the term allogeneic refers to receiving somebody else's cells. Autologous, the auto piece, means your own, essentially. So again, that would mean that we we take the cells from the affected patient, and those cells are the ones that are engineered and then given back to the patient after the manufacturing process is complete. So it's a similar process that we were just talking about this for MLD, but it's a similar process for ALD or adrenal leukodystrophy as well. And again, the cells would be accessed from, and these are all boys, it's an X-linked disease. The cells are accessed from the boys, they're manufactured. And then after we get the quality control back, it basically says that process that had gone the way we want it to, then we bring the kids back. We still have to treat them with chemotherapy as we would for the allogeneic side of things, for again, getting somebody else's cells, because you have to get rid of the existing bone marrow cells in the body so you can replace them with the engineered cells that have the opportunity to make the gene product. So kids still need to be in the hospitals and need to get chemotherapy, but again, it's a much easier process. They tend to get out faster and not be anywhere near as sick as they would be if they're getting somebody else's cells. So there are 67 kids treated on those studies. There were actually two studies looking at use of gene therapy for adrenal leukodystrophy. And we did, I think, 21 of those kids here. But nobody was lost going through the transplant process. So again, it's much easier on the families, much easier on the kids. And so that on the safety side, certainly, again, there's I don't think there's any doubt that autologous lentiviral mediated gene therapy, it's kind of a mouthful, but using that approach is going to be safer in the peritransplant period than using somebody else's cells. So in terms of the efficacy piece, again, it's a little bit different because that gene product is not an enzyme like the lysosomal enzyme diseases like metachromatic leukodystrophy. So we're still trying to better understand whether the auto-lenti gene therapy approach is going to be the same as the allogeneic approach that we've been employing for 30 years, essentially. So that a lot of that information is still kind of ongoing. There have been a few boys that have developed what looked like a pre-leukemic situation, having gone through that therapy as well. So that we're trying to better understand also. So that wasn't reflected in that paper because the paper is a few years old now, but there's additional reports that are going to be coming out better describing what we've seen in that circumstance.
Most recently, newborn screening has expanded to include MPS. A recent study showed that the delivery of hematopoietic stem and progenitor cells, known as HSPS gene therapy, in patients with MPS1 Herter syndrome resulted in extensive metabolic correction in the peripheral tissues and the central nervous system. As the director of the MPS Center at University of Minnesota, do you see an increased number of identified cases? And how will early treatment, such as using HSPS gene therapy and the long-term follow-up, impact the quality of life of your patients?
Well, this is an important question as well. So again, we've been doing allogeneic transplant, donor-derived cell infusions in the Hurler patients really since the mid to late 80s. So we have pretty extensive experience on what the outcomes are in those kids. And it's clear that transplant may be the best thing available for them, but we aren't curing those patients by any stretch. So a lot of those kids, so it's a multi-organ system disease. And so the kids have vision problems from corneal clouding. They can have hearing issues. They have airway problems. They can have cardiac issues. They have multiple skeletal issues where they may require hip surgery, knee surgery, carpal tunnel surgery. So there's a lot of different disease-related complications. And so as we look at different therapies, we want to better understand how these new therapies impact all those different aspects of the disease. So again, we pretty well understand what transplant using someone else's cells can offer patients. And again, it may be the best thing that we've got, but it's nowhere near a curative treatment. So we're very interested in the opportunity to do the gene therapy in these patients. There was, I think, 8 patients that were treated in Milan using the same kind of gene therapy that we were discussing before, harvesting the patient's cells, engineering them with the lentivirus, and administering the chemotherapy, but then reinfusing their own corrected cells. And so we don't have a lot of patients, and we don't have a long-term follow-up in that circumstance, but the data thus far looks really quite encouraging. All the patients have survived. They look like they may be growing better than we would otherwise anticipate. Their enzyme levels in general look to be significantly higher than we could achieve with allogeneic transplant. So it's something that we're quite excited about. So those first 8 patients were treated. The protocol was closed as they're monitoring the data. But being as the data looks quite compelling, the next move is to offer that in a number of different sites throughout the US and in Europe, and to get better experience in terms of how this will compare to transplant. So the protocol, actually, the FDA wanted to directly compare transplant, allogeneic transplant, again, using someone else's cells, to the new therapy where we engineer the kid's own cells. And so it'll be a randomized trial. We hope in this trial will open in the next 6 months or so. And then new patients with Hurler would be identified. They would be either randomized to either get allogeneic transplant or to get the new gene therapy. And we'll be able to compare the patients on that basis in terms of their outcomes, get a sense of how much, assuming that the gene therapy actually is better than transplant, how much better that that might be. So again, we're anticipating that we'll be able to do this in the next maybe even few months. Minnesota will be one of the sites. There'll be a couple other sites in the US, and there'll be, I think, 5 sites that are being discussed throughout Europe. And that'll give us an opportunity to better understand how much better, if it is better, if it proves to be better, how much better that this new therapy might be than what we've been doing historically.
Thank you, Dr. Orchard. You and your colleagues' work is truly worldwide and very transformative. You mentioned so many ends across the different diseases and different studies that you've described for our listeners. Can you share any stories of inspiration that keeps you going over the last several decades?
Yeah, I mean, I've now been doing this for a while. So it really is gratifying when, you know, patients come back to see us. So for instance, for the Hurler patients, there's a number of different disease-related issues that can pop up despite having gone through transplant. So we have a lot of the families that come back on a yearly basis, or maybe every other year basis, and they see a number of our practitioners in orthopedics and cardiology and endocrine and neuropsychology and all these types of things. So they come back for a few days to a week for these long-term follow-ups. And you know, some of the kids that we transplanted at a year of age or 2 years of age are now graduating from high school and, you know, looking at what they're going to be doing with their lives and whatnot. So untreated, the Hurler kids generally die by the time they're 10. And so that's a very, it's a very gratifying thing to see, is that these kids are now planning what they're going to do with their lives. Whereas without any type of therapy, they likely wouldn't be around.
Dr. Orchard, thank you so much for sharing these stories of inspiration. The Newborn Screening Translational Research Network, NBS Trend, is involved in building community of stakeholders, including health professionals, researchers, state programs, clinicians like yourself, families, advocacy organizations. What ways do you see MBS Trent and other rare disease organizations help your research and patient care?
Well, I think better understanding the outcomes for these patients is going to be critically important. So on clinical trials, generally the outcome parameters are somewhat uniform because the companies that are running the clinical trials defines what kind of endpoints they want to look at. But for instance, for the adrenoleukodystrophy patients, that gene therapy has now been licensed. It was licensed almost a year ago. And so now patients are going to be treated on an ongoing basis in some of the centers that have this open. There'll be others, gene therapies that are going to get licensed too, hopefully metachromatic leukodystrophy, for instance. But thalassemia and sickle cell and a number of other disorders are kind of on the map too. But especially as these patients are now going to be receiving licensed therapy, if we can better understand what the outcomes are going to be, that would be really important. So maybe there's an opportunity for you to help in that sort of circumstance. And in terms of just being able to identify the patients earlier and get the newborn screening together for some of these diseases is going to be very important. MPS1 was added to the RUS, the Recommended Uniform Screening Panel, at the same time adrenoleukodystrophy was, I think in February of 2016, but there's only about 35 to 40 states that are screening for those disorders now. And so being able to move these things forward as expeditiously as we can and implementing newborn screening is going to be key in the opportunity to provide meaningful therapy for these patients moving forward.
Dr. Orchard, are you involved in training the new generation of pediatricians? And if you are, what do you tell them about newborn screening research and rare diseases?
Well, so there's a couple of aspects of that question, I think. So one is to reach out to the general pediatricians that are out there and help them better understand what these disorders are all about. And if they were to get a call, for instance, that newborn screening recognized that one of their patients have a new disorder or disorder that was identified by newborn screening, to prepare them for that initial conversation with the families. So I think that's going to be a very important aspect of things and, you know, where their care should go after that and how to get in touch with the geneticists or others that might be able to help the families with these difficult diagnoses. Another thing that I'm very interested in too is helping train the next generation to focus on the rare diseases and to utilize the kids that are picked up by or utilize newborn screening to identify these kids that can be picked up very early and then be able to offer them the support that they need and potential interventions that they need as well. So we're trying to better understand how we can reach out to some of the junior people that may be early in their careers and help them understand that this is an exciting area. There's a lot going on and there's a lot to offer in terms of new interventions and to help these families who are in a very difficult situation.
Dr. Orchard, thank you so much for joining us today on our Newborn Screening Spotlight podcast. Your work and your colleagues are doing such inspiring work, and we look forward to learning more. We end our podcast with a signature question, and that is, what does newborn screening research means to you?
Well, it's extremely important. I wasn't actually that involved with the newborn screening aspect of things until maybe the last decade or so, and it became very clear that early identification of these disorders was absolutely imperative to being able to help minimize the progression of the disorders. And so it's absolutely clear that these things, the newborn screening aspect of things, is going to be able to help us offer more hope to the families for these patients that are affected with these rare, difficult disorders. I'm now involved, for instance, in some of the discussions with the departments of health here in Minnesota and the state legislature in trying to figure out how to grease the wheels to make some of these things happen. So that's it's a relatively new hat that I wear, but it's very obvious to me that it's going to be critically important, and I'll do what we can to help get these things off the ground as quickly as we can.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Newborn Screening Spotlight. If you like our podcast, please subscribe and share an episode with your colleagues, friends, and family. Get involved.
Stay informed.
Help us advance discoveries. Together, let's increase the impact of newborn screening research by listening to your stories.